Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hang on to your balls. It's time for the Horror Hangout Podcast.
Welcome to the Horror Hangout Podcast, where two bearded film fans watch the 50 best horror movies ever, and then we do some talking about them. My name is Luke Condor with a K. My nose is a bit blocked because I had a neti pot earlier. I explained to Ben. If you don't know what that is, Google it. And I'm joined by Mr.
Ben Errington, and I haven't had a neti pot, so I should be fine, you know.
I just thought I'd explain it, because I feel like every one of the last episodes, like the last four episodes, I've been coughing and I've been sneezing and stuff. It's the hay fever, so I thought, right, I'm going to get on top of this. And I got a neti pot, and I thought it would clear it out. I think it's cleared it out. I think it's just, my nose is still a bit blocked.
Do you want to explain briefly what a neti pot is, just in case people are like, what on earth has he been doing to his orifices?
I would say just Google it. But it's a plastic teapot that you shove in your sinus.
You shove it right in your sinus, and it feels bloody lovely.
It feels weird. It feels like training for like waterboarding. You know, like a torture training
for
like to withstand it. I mean,
like, I so they're just building.
I don't think you can be good at being waterboarded, but you can be good at withstanding it. Yeah.
Can you be good at waterboarding though? You probably can.
No.
Strictly against waterboarding or any form of torture. Geneva Convention.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so the last film we talked about was Wreck with the lovely Johan Chabot. Thank you very much, Johan, for coming up for that. And this time we are on number 33 of the list, and we are talking about the classic that is right on the precipice of Ben's Cliff. I wasn't going to talk about Ben's Cliff, but it's coming to my mind again.
It's like the elephant in the room now. Yeah. It's become like the elephant in the room. You want to talk about my cliff?
It's called Don't Look Now. It's from 1973. So do you want to tell us a bit about the film, Ben?
It's your thing. Okay. So Don't Look Now is a 1973 independent British-Italian film directed by Nicholas Roeg. Is a thriller adapted from the short story by Daphne du Maurier. Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland portray a married couple who travel to Venice following the recent accidental death of their daughter after the husband accepts a commission to restore a church. They encounter two sisters, one of who claims to be clairvoyant and informs them that their daughter is trying to contact them and warn them of danger. The husband at first dismisses their claims but starts to experience mysterious sightings himself. I understand that is probably a lot the longest intro / synopsis that I've had so far. Usually try to go a bit brief, but I guess it's good to kind of paint a picture of this film because it's an intense one.
So this is what is that it? Have you still got more? Part two.
Oh, that's it, mate. That's it. I mean, I could do more. I could do more if you want. I mean, I could do. I could be here all night.
No, don't worry. I think this is gonna go with some of the same stuff anyway. So this is what the Empire magazine had to say about it. Nick Roeg's hugely influential take on Daphne du Maurier's short story is more than just a simple horror movie. It's also a moving and insightful study of marriage, particularly the way it creaks like the hull of a ship under the duress of loss and grief. But yes, ultimately it's scary in a way that's cranked up several notches by its eerie backdrop of Venice in off-season, weird encounters with seers, and that red-coated hobgoblin. Julie Christie, lost in her grief for her drowned daughter, and Donald Sutherland, adrift in his, are note perfect as the central couple. But Roeg's direction and editing, particularly in the sexy sex scene, lend the movie the feel of a beautiful but shattered mosaic. You got 96% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'll give you a guess what it got on IMDb.
was it 7? Well, it might be 7.4. Was it 7.4? Was it
7.3? It's
This film is going to be awful. I've already watched it. This film's awful. 7.3.
Yeah.
If you want to be taking yourself seriously in the IMDb stakes, you've got to be 7.4 or higher. If you're 7.3, forget about it.
Yeah.
Can I also just make a point that Empire description then was absolutely amazing. It was
good.
Poetic. It was laden with metaphor. It was who wrote that? You know, because usually we call them the film.
This is guy. This guy was studying film on the side. He actually was doing Shakespeare studies.
Yeah, it was delightful.
Yeah,
it was a soliloquy.
Yeah. So on the Facebook group, the Horror Hangout Facebook group, Kev Hurst said, "It's got a great unsuspecting ending, dude." Edward Harvey says, "Yep, great suspenseful build to climax. That's a climax that's worth it. Classic movie." He didn't do that, I imagine.
I love a movie that builds up to a real good climax. You want a good climax at the end of the movie?
I like a great unsuspecting end.
Unsuspected. Yeah. Hopefully not an end, you know, a premature end. You know, that's the one where you're like, oh, God, this... Whoa, sorry about that. That doesn't usually happen to me, you know. Sorry about that. Sorry.
So have you seen this film before?
I have seen this film before. I saw it a number of years ago. I can't remember how or why I came across this film. I think I heard it referenced in something, maybe a podcast years ago, and I went away and watched it. I think when I watched it the first time, I was kind of in and out watching it. I wasn't 100% sort of like engrossed. Yeah. This time I give it my attention.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it's got a hell of a lot going on. There's a hell of a lot going on. You could probably watch this numerous times to pick through all the visual metaphors and all the themes and everything it kind of suggests. Some of the stuff that comes full circle is really interesting. But yeah, like, again, this is probably, I think we've experienced quite a lot of actual horror films. But I think early in the list, we were watching a lot of films which were like a psychological thriller with horror elements. And I think this is probably one of them. You wouldn't necessarily, if I said, come around mine and watch this horror film, and then I put that on, you'd probably be like, this ain't horror, mate. This is just, especially during the sex scene, you'd be confused.
Yeah. Cat, we were confused at one point because I've not seen this before. And it's been on my sort of, I want to watch it list for a while because I saw Ben Wheatley reference it as one of his, films that's inspired him. And you can see that.
Yeah, definitely.
I was going to say in the editing, that sort of mosaic, non-time linear sort of thing, jumping back and forth in the cutaways, that's something he's done a few times, I think, especially in like a field in England, so you can definitely see that sort of influence there.
Yeah, and it was like definitely a breakdown of like these two human psyches dealing with grief, and it was interesting how they sort of like broke down in different ways and were affected in different ways, but I think it was portrayed very well by like Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. And it was a very sort of like, it's a very, very stylish film, isn't it? I mean, it's good that it takes place in Venice, because I think Venice is somewhere that you never really, but it was creepy as hell, Venice, in this film. It was terrifying. Yeah. Like all the little alcoves and the little alleyways. And
the way you couldn't quite see someone. There wasn't like a straight road to see someone down.
Everyone was just like the water as well. Just the water being there was just like this constant threat that something was going to go wrong. It was just, it was weird that, it was sort of like in a very unsteady feeling I felt throughout.
I would say some of the editing. So the editing in my mind sort of makes this film as effective as it is. There was so I'm a big fan of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. Have you ever watched Garth Marenghi's Dark Place?
Yeah, man.
The scene where like I think Matt Berry touches Liz, and then it has like the same sort of cuts, and it has him screaming, ah, and it just cuts to like. Right. And I was like, there's elements in this. I was like, that reminds you of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Yeah.
But it's still effective. I think in the hands of someone not as talented as Roeg or whoever did actually edit this film, I think it could have come across very silly, but it didn't. Yeah, I think it was very definitely good. Yeah.
Yeah, there are definitely times when it kind of almost felt like it was going to veer into silliness, but then it kind of like reined itself in a little bit. It was a bit.
Yeah. And that ending, my memory was I'm just thinking that I did not expect that ending. I'm still not quite sure if I understand what's happening. It was almost Lynchian in a sort of abstractness of it.
Yeah, I mean, very Lynchian in terms of
a dwarf.
As a dwarf, that's exactly dwarfs. What I was thinking.
That's like Lynchian.
Red, and dwarves. I mean, that's very Lynchian. That's incredibly Lynchian.
Have you been watching the new TV series, by the way?
I haven't.
There's
a what?
A killer dwarf. Yeah.
A killer dwarf. Yeah. Is there a giant? See, I was kind of like, I need to get. I've seen about half an episode of the third series, so
yeah,
I need to chill.
It's good.
I think the ending was like. In my head, and I think everything I've read and sort of seen of the ending since has kind of built the ending up to more, and I forget how it is very subtle. Like, it's kind of a bit like, well, what's going to happen here? Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Whereas I think my memory of this ending was a bit more of a like, whoa, I think if there was more of him chasing after this hooded figure throughout the film. I mean, there was some, but if there was a lot more,
it seems to come so far out of left field. And we'll talk about that when we get into the plot, but like the whole, like, there's a serial killer on the loose. I'm sure that doesn't get introduced till halfway through the film.
Yeah.
And that's the way that's a big part of the way the film ends. It just seemed like so sort of random for me, but I really liked it though still.
Yeah. I like the use of sort of like premonition as well. Like some of the things he was seeing were premonitions.
Yeah.
Some were more effective than others. Cause some were sort of like very signposted moments.
Yeah.
But moments where, you know, he sees somebody and it ends up being a premonition of his own funeral. I think, do you know what I mean? That's insane.
It's cool. I like it. I like it a lot.
That's really cool. That's really cool.
So should we talk about the story?
Oh, if we have to, Luke, you're bloody bending my arm on you. Yeah. Go on.
Okay. So the key players in the story, we've got Julie Christie playing the wife, Laura Baxter, Donald Sutherland playing the husband, John Baxter.
Great facial hair. Great.
He's got a proper moustache in there and an afro thing going on as well. Very 70s. Hilary Mason plays Heather. I can't pronounce his name. Clelia Natania plays Wendy. I'm not too sure which of those sisters are which, but I'm sure we'll figure it out as we go. Okay, so
the two crazy old women.
When I was watching the film, it was Ben Wheatley talking about the films have inspired him. The bit in the film, in this film that he was talking about, was specifically the drowning scene, which is right at the start. And it is pretty horrific. So it sort of opens with like this stately home in England, middle class. That's looking down at me from the TV screen. So Donald Sutherland is looking through his photo snaps. I think his wife's drinking some tea. I can't really remember. And then the kids... There's a son and a daughter, and they're playing out in this massive garden, and one of them dies. I don't even know how it happens, really. How did it die?
Well, she's playing with like a little action man, a little action man who's very well spoken. I kept thinking she's pulling this little cord and is going like, "Oh bloody, I'm going to get you Germans!" And it's like that action man, what a square.
Yeah,
who's recorded the voice for that?
Middle class. Yeah, middle class action.
Yeah. She's playing around with a ball as well, and then the kid's just like running around. The boy is running around willy nilly, and then she ends up falling in the water and drowning. But obviously, the important part of this is that Donald Sutherland's character, what's his name again? Moustache Man, Bob Ross,
John Baxter,
big old Baxter just has he has a feeling, doesn't he? And he sees a photo with some sort of like red. Ink.
I think he's developing them, isn't he? And he gets water on him, or wine or something, and it like smears this blood red smear that comes across it.
Yeah, and then he automatically feels that something's wrong, and he kind of rushes out to find his daughter, who's only gone and drowned in the pond.
Interestingly, we don't explore who drowned the daughter. Could have been the action man. Could have been the brother.
Came to life in a small soldier sort of way and just went, "Get in the bloody pond." could have been
Nazi
the brother.
Girl. It could have been the brother. Yeah.
Because he was useless, let's be honest. Useless.
Yeah.
If you ever need someone in a time of great need, this guy is not the guy, because he kind of just watched. Oh, bloody hell. I know he's just a kid, but come on, mate.
Come on.
Done a bit of first aid training, surely. Diving after your sis.
So basically, it cuts to Donald Sutherland running out, and he sees his daughter drowned in the pond. And he knew it was happening because of the photo. He sort of felt it happening. And then he goes in, and he sort of pulls her out. And at this point, I thought Donald Sutherland in slow motion sounded a lot like Professor Snape. Like, he's got this very deep, like, like, do you know what I mean? That sort of Harry Potter.
I like in this moment, a great tragedy where I was really feeling for the characters, and I was thinking, I was really mourning the death. And I was, yeah. it was cutting me deep. And you were just there going, sounds like Snape, slow down, he does it. Sounds like Snape, what a bloody mug.
It reminded me of Brian Bedonde. It's Brian Bedonde.
Brian Bedonde.
At times, like, I don't know how.
Curse you.
Like, he probably had, I don't know how. Donald Sutherland, like, I do think he's got a deep voice, but I think in the slow motion, it just went crazy over the
maybe
top.
Maybe it happens to all of us. Maybe when we're slowed down, that happens to all of us, you know. We should slow down this. We can slow down this conversation. We all sound like no.
Okay. So then they the daughter dies. It is a pretty heart wrenching scene because the wife comes out and she's screaming her head off and stuff.
That was a blood curdling scream. He's doing a bit of CPR on her, but he's doing a bit of half assed. You know, he's doing it. She's led on her side.
Yeah. This is like the catalyst scene, isn't it? This is like the scene that sets the entire film up, really. We've got like a lot of water imagery and sounds and stuff. We've got the red on the picture and the photo, the red of the coat that the daughter's wearing.
Yeah.
It's all set here for the rest of the film to reference. And it's quite effective. And then it suddenly seems to cut forward. John apparently has got a commission what was he doing? Restoring a church.
It's restoring a church, yeah. So a bishop's called him up. He's gone, John, mate, I know your daughter's just died, but this church needs sorting out quick, sharp. And he's gone, Birch needs sorting out. Yes, I'll be there. How long after the death and them going on a little jolly to Venice passes by, do we think?
I think he says. I think it's like a few months. I think so. Anyway, I might have made that up, but I would assume a few months. It couldn't be like a next Tuesday job, could it?
No, I thought maybe a bit longer. I think maybe in my head I was trying to think, was it a year or so? But maybe it was shorter than that. Yeah. And obviously they leave their son at boarding school.
Do we only find out later on? Like, where the hell's the son? Like, they got rid of him as well.
Yeah,
the toy soldier attacked him. Okay, and then they're in Venice. It's all very nice, all very European. I was quite jealous.
Yeah, I was loving it. I was loving it. I was thinking, I want to be there. You know, I don't want to be getting over the death of a family member there, but I want to be there enjoying everything. They seem to be going out on lovely meals, seeing all the sights, staying in a lovely hotel sort of apartment
little
building.
Little workshop thing he's got. Yeah, it's really lovely.
He's wearing lovely. Freshly pressed, lovely suits, walking around. He's the belle of the ball. He's got a lovely mustache. He's got a lovely mustache too. I'm not jealous of 1973 Donald Sutherland. Don't look now.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe I am, you know, used to say.
Oh, it's a shame you can't talk like a normal person. Okay.
That's the bad thing that comes with it. You can have all these great things.
It's almost like that mustache is too heavy for him to, like, enunciate around the words properly.
Yeah. Just shave the mustache off, John. For God's sake, I'm sick of you speaking like that. It's stylish. It's 1973.
he was pretty hip. He is very hip. In fact, the suits are actually quite nice. And I think he'd look like a proper hipster today.
Donald Sutherland is still alive, yeah? He is, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in The Hunger Games. That's the only thing I can think of at the minute.
Yeah, that's right. He is, isn't he?
Yeah. And he's always
Hunger Games.
He's a proper silver fox now. Yeah. So they're at this restaurant, or they're eating somewhere, it's like a cafe or something, and then it's these two women off to the side just looking over at them all the time. They go to the bathroom, John's wife goes to the bathroom. They actually seem fairly happy, by the way, at this point. They don't seem
yeah,
grieving too badly. So it must have been a good while.
Yeah, so maybe they were like slightly getting over it at this point. Yeah. One of the old ladies gets something in her eye, didn't she?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so
little bit of dust.
And then the wife goes to sort of help her get the dust out. She's like, I'm good at this. My time has come. You're good at restoring churches, John. Leave the eye dust to me. So she goes, and then she helps one of them's eye out. And then the other one is like blind. She's like, bloody hell, what did you get in your eye? And then...
acid. In this scene, there's a really weird woman who's just like kind of in there as well. Yeah. It's like they've just a little, there's like a little lady in the doorway just watching everything unfold. And I kept thinking, what's your game? What is your game? Are you lurking in the women's toilets just waiting for anyone to come in with eye dust and, you know, grieving their kids and just watching stuff unfold?
Does she kind of like just peer in around the door at one point and go,
oh, yes, eye dust. And then just blind, are you? Mm.
Yeah. So the blind one is suddenly comes out with a corker. She says, I'm psychic, mate, and
Derek,
I can see
Derek
your...
Derek Acora.
I'm psychic and I can see Derek Acora right now. So
Derek,
so she can see, she says, I can see your daughter and she's happy. And she's like laughing and smiling along. She's happy. And I was like, look, even if you're a psychic, you've been a psychic all your life, there must be some etiquette like involved. Like, you don't go straight in there with your dead daughter's there. Do you know what I mean? Like, ease it in.
Maybe she's new to being a psychic. You know, she's quickly got these gifts and she doesn't know how to control it. You know, so she's just flying in there going, hey, your dead daughter's happy. Hey, your dead son's, these nothing so good. Hey, your mom, she's okay.
Yeah. Like, the kid from The Sixth Sense had some etiquette. He knew. He didn't just go around telling everyone, you know. But, okay, so then I think the wife is happy about this or something. She goes back to...
I think initially she's kind of a little bit unsure, I think, isn't she? She's not... Yeah. She's kind of like, oh... you see at this point, maybe that's she kind of needs that. She needs that sort of thing to sort of help her with the closure. But she's a little bit unsure, a little bit dubious, because these women do come across as, while nice, perhaps a little bit crackpotty.
English as well.
They're English. Okay, definitely untrustworthy.
I was going to say, how creepy are the blind woman's eyes, by the way? Like, I've seen blind people, and they've never been quite as creepy as that. I don't know how I don't know, she looked like a corpse or something in a way, like...
Very milky.
Very milky. Yeah.
Milky and blue, like a blueberry milkshake.
Yeah, like cream, like you can stick a straw in and suck one out.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was in trouble. It was thick.
Now I'm psychic.
I juice.
Yeah. Okay.
Now I'm psychic. Fuck you.
So then she goes to. She faints, doesn't she? She goes back to the dinner table.
Yeah, she faints. She goes back to the table and faints. And just, you know what I mean? This is one of those where she faints. And I think, could they have made any more mess? She could have just...
Oh, yeah. Like,
she could have just fell over and fainted.
she
kind of goes for the table. Donald Sutherland, like, stands up at the same time. And the person who must run this restaurant must be like... The person who runs this restaurant must be like, for fuck. There's balsamic vinegar everywhere.
Yeah,
they've destroyed the table.
It's not even like a normal, like you have a sandwich, it's a full tapas thing going on.
Yeah,
there's like it's a buffet table they're on or something.
Like even though Donald Sutherland's probably thinking, I want to make sure my wife's okay because she fainted. I bet he's thinking in his head somewhere about the bill. Jesus, this was bloody. This is this was 100 euro. This it's not euros. It's 1973. This is 100. What's Italian?
You ever watch? Oh no, there's that TV show. I can't remember what it's. But a guy, there's like a blind guy. He walks into like a china shop and he slips over and he starts hitting like everything as he's going and he keeps trying to stand up and hitting other stuff. And, like that's exactly what it felt like. But on the buffet
table. It's not Jackass.
Yeah, it sounds like a Jackassy thing. So I imagine. I think it might be.
He's the old guy.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah, it was an OTT faint where I was like, oh my god. Yeah. Like the slightly the neat part of me there was really going wild, like, oh, there's balsamic vinegar everywhere and there's like things smashing, and I was just like, whoa, not into that. That was the scariest bit of the film for me.
Yeah.
The table going
everywhere. I enjoyed it. I'm a punk.
I'm a punk, man. Yeah. And they took her to hospital, didn't they?
Yeah, and then so she's like, I'm happy. John's like, look, I don't believe you. Probably didn't happen. I don't believe that these people are psychic, but I'm glad you're happy, if it helps you in any way.
He's sort of glad that she seems a little bit chirpier, and she's probably helped her a bit of closure.
Yeah.
But obviously he's very cynical about these of old blueberry milkshake eyes and the other one. Yeah. Sort of, I mean, is it good for her? You know, it's one of those things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things. When you hear people talk about that, they say, yeah, I'm going to see a clairvoyant. I'm going to see somebody to talk about dead relatives. I personally always think, is that the best thing to do?
And here we have, as this came on the film, I was like, I said to Kat, ha, here we have the formula for the supernatural horror film. So we have the skeptic husband and we have the believing wife, and he doesn't believe her. And it ends with him, badly for him.
It's like the opposite of the X-Files. It's the opposite to Mulder and Scully, with Mulder being the guy who's believing everything, Scully being the skeptic. I mean, it's a good sort of dynamic, even though this isn't a supernatural.
I was trying to think of other ones. So Drag Me to Hell, I guess that used that formula. So it was like the woman believed in the seance stuff and the guy didn't. Like, it's proper genre trope. But,
the only thing that annoys me about it with the X-Files is the fact that so much happens and they've gone through like series after series after series of seeing, you know, mutant blokes and aliens and different mutoids and different things. And when an episode
slippy,
starts,
Scully's, elongated men. Yeah.
Yeah. When an episode starts and Mulder's like, oh, I heard about this man, he got three knobs. Scully's like, shut up, you're talking shit.
Yeah. I think they will end the whole series and they'll find out that Scully's mentally ill, mentally retarded. Yeah.
she even gets abducted by aliens at some point. And they go, you got abducted by some aliens there. She goes, shut up, wind your neck in.
The funny thing is, I think I might be the same. I'm completely skeptical. So I remember, like, so Kat's the opposite to me. So she believes in stuff. This is the horror movie formula I was talking about. So she hears like a door closes or something on its own. She will instantly think ghosts. Like, that's the first thing. I'll be like, wind or something. But like, for her, it's just ghosts. Could be more likely ghosts.
Yeah. Ghosts, the wind. Ghosts, the wind.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no wind, it's the ghost.
It's a windy ghost. Okay. So what happened? Where the hell are we in the film? Okay, so we're at the sex scene. Okay.
Yeah.
At what point did you feel like you were watching a 70s porno?
Pretty much all the way through. I didn't see any bush though, which was disappointing.
Yeah.
So obviously they go back to their little apartment. They have a little chat and then they start having sex. Strange soundtrack for sex.
I felt like it
was very jaunty piano to start with. Then it got very jazz. You know, there was lots going on. I felt like if that music was in the room while they were trying to have sex, they find it hard to find some rhythm.
Yeah.
Because it was like,
it was a bit. Scatty, not the sex, the music.
Well, it seems like I had a good time.
And it's a weird one, isn't it? Because it seems to use that same fragmented editing thing, so they're sort of jumping around in time. Still a little bit ominous, but it's got like family-friendly music, a couple of nipple shots.
Yeah, we do get a nice little sort of bit where they're. Is it? I think it's post-sex. I think it's pre, where she's in the bath and he's sort of like weighing himself naked. You kind of get to understand, you know, that most of his weight is just his mustache, because he weighs himself and he's like 165 kilos or something like that. That's 80 kilos of mustache right there.
Yeah, and we do see a bit of muff. We see a bit of his head muff. Afro thing.
Down there? Okay.
Yeah,
that's fine. I can deal with that.
Okay. Moving on from the sex scene. Which caused a bit of a stir, but we'll go into that in the trivia later on. But so then they go out for dinner, and then we really get like they get lost, I think, and they really get an idea of sort of how scary Venice is at night.
Yeah,
there's all the silhouettes, there's stuff moving. There's one bit where a guy just shouts, Like, he's suddenly, I think he just opens his window and goes, "Bada!" And then, and I was like, I don't really know what that guy wants, but he's creepy.
Miss Scusi.
Oh, sorry. I'm not very good with Italian, sorry.
Yeah.
He shouts something in Italian, doesn't he? And someone, and he's like, Jesus
what's,
Christ.
What's God. He shouting that for? Like, at 2 in the morning or whatever it is.
He was watching Juventus versus AC Milan. And
Lazio! Yeah, it could be.
Lazio. It was probably Lazio. It might have been Lazio in 73. Yeah. Oh, Lazio. It's like, Jesus, keep it down, mate.
Yeah. So they're sort of getting lost. They're sort of running around. And then we see the first, what looks like his kid, the drowned daughter,
yeah,
in like a red coat, running by, and he sees her, and I think he loses her, and then they go somewhere outside for another meal or something, aren't they? Whatever they get up to.
Yeah, I mean, they're living a high life, aren't they? They're having a good meal. They might have just seen a potential spectre of their dead daughter, but they're thinking, let's go out and get some lovely food. Now, we've worked me up a big appetite, that has.
Yeah, yeah. So then we cut the next day. John is working on a church, doing some churchy stuff, and then Laura walks off. He's up in the scaffolding, and he sees Laura walking off with the two sisters, the seance sisters, whatever their names are.
Oh, the bloody seance sisters. There she goes with the seance sister. I told you to stay away from them. Nothing but a bad influence on you.
What happens is, so they have a seance, and then the blind one starts mouthing off, right?
Yeah, but this is a bit confusing, because the blind one starts titting herself up. I was a little bit confused by this bit, because she was kind of like, I don't know how to explain this bit. They're having a seance, and it seemed like she was trying to contact possibly Christine's daughter. But during it, she was kind of like, I can only describe it as titting herself up and being terrified. She was titting herself up. Sorry, I know I've got to do it, because, you know, I'm just titting herself up like that.
For the audio people, you might be able to hear that, like, friction. That's Ben titting himself up.
Oh, jeez, Christ. But yeah, she was doing that, and she was kind of panicking, and it was good. You kind of got the gist that she'd seen or heard something bad that was sexy, alluding to John's death. Yeah. Maybe that was why she was touching herself in that way, because she found John and his lovely hair and his Bob Ross hair and his lovely moustache.
Yeah.
Incredibly sexually attractive. But she was going for a hammer and tong, you know. I mean, seen some titting up in my time, Luke, but that was extreme. That was like, oh, yeah, careful.
Titting up 2.0. So then they have the sound. So she says, look, John's got to leave Venice. Something bad's going to happen to him. You have to leave Venice.
Yeah.
And around here, they get a call from the son, who we haven't seen since the very first opening scene. He's in boarding school back in grisly old England. He's taking a knock. He's hurt his head. And they say, you've got to come, like, the wife says, I think, I've got to go back. Interestingly, he doesn't go back. He says, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to do this work.
Yeah, yeah. So he's like, you go and sort our little boy out and I'll stay here. The church ain't going to get churched itself, mate.
They really don't know. They need a good church in. What did you think of the church itself?
What did I think to it? I thought it looked like a shithole, to be honest, mate. It looked like a shithole.
Yeah.
I just thought, this is going to be a bloody lot of work. And at one point when he was just like putting a mosaic back together with his hands, I thought, that's a mug's job. Do you know what I mean? That's going to take hours, days, months. You're never going to leave Venice. You've just been told you're potentially in danger, and you're staying here to restore a church that could take ages in Venice. Get out of there, man.
Yeah. So I mean, it looks like it's going to be a lot of work. And like, when he's talking to all the Italian people, he's got like, I think he knows like two words in Italian or something. And he always sounds like annoyed. Like, he sounds like the worst part. It's like saying faster or harder. faster. And like, he just sounds like the worst boss in the world. So Laura goes back to England to check on the son. And at this point, John's getting on with his normal day. He's on a boat going around the, what did they call them in Venice? The streets.
The streets. The streets of Venice? I don't know. Going around the, I don't know. The, like, I thought you were going to say about the boats.
But... rivers or something, aren't it? Like, whatever. Yeah, so
it's like the river, streets.
River streets. Is that what they call it? Yeah.
They're called like so the gondola's the boat.
Yeah.
And the Venice rivers are called the
boat. Can't find it. Boat.
Grand Canal? No, that ain't right. I know what you mean though. They're called something else, aren't they?
So so he's on his way down a river street and he sees coming the other way is the two sisters and his wife, and he's like, what the Laura? Yeah. He starts shouting for them. They're all dressed in black. Obviously they haven't seen him, or they're just ignoring him because they're blanking him as if they're giving him a silent treatment. And they're like in a funeral procession, so it's sort of like a gondola hearse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was cool. Obviously, because it was a bit like we were kind of in the same position as him at this point, where he was like, "What? Why? Who?
At this point, have they said that John's got second sight? Or no. Is that later on?
No. I haven't said this at this point. Okay. But this is all kind of like new information, brand new information.
Yeah. So anyway, so if John's like, "Well, my wife's in Venice, but she's lost the marbles," and by the way, we've suddenly been told about a serial killer. This is what I mean by this seems to come like so out of left field. Like, there's some serial killings happening.
Yeah, because he kind of spots. He's with some. Who's he with when they watch a body get pulled?
The guy is working on the church. Yeah.
At this point, I was confused and thought it maybe was Laura.
Yeah, me too.
I was looking for ages at her, and I was thinking that is her, isn't it? And I was surprised because, to be fair, it's just a woman getting pulled out of a river. I mean, I think if I was far away and I saw a woman getting pulled out of a river and I was worried that my wife was in Venice, I think I'd go for a closer look.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was a bit like, he just saw and went, "Nah, I recognize those pants, not my missus."
There were dirty pants as well. Just noticed that. And I was gonna say,
like he said, just noticed that, as if it was like some sort of something to be proud of somehow.
I
noticed that the pants were dirty. I'd hate to see your notes written about this film, because I guarantee you, in capitals, is dirty pants in Sharpie.
Well, I'm not a fan of dirty pants. So I was going to say, around this point in the film, I started to get a bit confused as to, wait, so where is Laura? And also, was that Laura? Who's this serial killer? Why is there suddenly a serial killer?
I think we were supposed to be feeling like that. And I think it was kind of supposed to...
Like, mirrors his, what Donald Sutherland's feeling right now, because I think he starts to get a bit confused about time and what's real and what isn't.
Yeah, it's almost like it kind of represents his kind of descent into...
Yeah,
I don't want to say madness, because I don't think he fully goes into madness, but his descent into this sort of uncertainty and the grief kind of.
Yeah.
Because I think he thinks he's dealing with the grief quite well, and on the surface, it seems like he is dealing with this grief quite well. It doesn't seem like in any way he's being affected too badly, but clearly his mental psyche is kind of falling apart a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so at some point now, he gets a phone call from England. Saying the son's okay, and it's Laura. Laura's in England still, and she's coming up to Venice that day. So now he's realised that maybe he's losing his mind a little bit here. He goes back to the police station to say, look, oh, by the way, earlier he reported his wife missing, so she's not missing. And then he helps take the seance woman home for some reason. I'm not really too sure why.
Yeah, well, sort of in... A lot of stuff happens to the police in this sort of thing. So he reported her missing, then goes back to say she wasn't missing. But then the police inspector also has him followed briefly, where I'm not sure whether he thinks that Donald... Johnald. I like that name, Johnald. So he seems to think that Johnald is somehow involved in A, the serial killings, or B, like he's done his wife in. So he has him followed briefly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Johnald's doing nothing for him to make himself look like an upstanding member of society here, is he? I mean,
no.
And then obviously after the police bring Heather in for questioning, he takes her back to the hotel.
Yeah.
What does he take her back to a hotel for? No, not that.
I think he just takes her back. Maybe he feels guilty that she's been taken for questioning or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
So then he leaves her, and then he sees the red, the girl that looks like his daughter moving in through the night streets of Venice. And at the same time, his wife's just got back. She's like running for him, trying to find him. And then, so this is the ending, really. It's a lot of running around. It's all getting quite tense because we keep hearing that John Order's going to die at some point. And then he goes
The blind lady has a bit of a meltdown at this point as well, doesn't she? I mean, she was pretty calm while he was there. And as soon as he leaves, she kind of like goes into a little bit of a meltdown. Like she's seeing something, like she's seeing the premonition of him possibly dying, and she falls between two beds. beds there. You could fall on either of them.
Yeah.
I'll just fall between them. Yeah. No, don't fall on that one or that one. Between them's fine.
But these women in this film cannot fall properly. They're just falling between stuff, on the food.
Yeah. There's a lot of like, I'm going to have a fall now. Now, I know when you faint or whatever, you're not in control of your body or whatever.
Yeah.
But my God. If I was directing this film, I'd just be like, I know this probably ain't realistic, but just fall on the bed.
Yeah. John Ord, he finds the little red coat, the child. It looks like his daughter. And then she turns around.
This bit was kind of like agonizing, because when he was chasing after her, there was a bit where like he used a boat. He untied a boat, got on it, and like got across a little river bit to get at her. And I kept thinking, this is agonizing. Like, it just seemed like she was running away. And I was thinking, she's going to get out of it. It reminded me of Silent Hill. You know, when you're chasing after the little girl at the start of Silent Hill, when she's just like constantly out of reach.
Yeah.
It just felt like that, where he was really trying to sort of get after her. And at this point, I guess we as the viewer are kind of just thinking, like, what is that going to be? Is that going to be like
a ghost or something?
A ghost of his daughter? But he follows her into a sort of old abandoned... And that old church. Abandoned building. It's church, isn't it?
Because they have like thingy windows. I even wonder if it is the one that he's working on. It probably isn't. I'm just like pulling it out of my ass.
One thing we have missed. I'm not sure when in the film this took place, but there was a part where he kind of fell from some scaffolding.
Yeah.
Which so he's working on the church. I guess this was kind of like halfway through. I think it was after Laura had gone home.
Yeah.
He kind of falls from some scaffolding and hangs there for ages. It was like Gladiators, wasn't it? It was like Gladiators Hang Tough.
He was just
hanging there. Like, oh!
There was a bit of the whole... He's swinging and going...
there were some really weird noises coming from him. Obviously, they were you could tell they were added afterwards. He was kind of like, hey! And then someone got up there and was just like poking him with a stick, trying to get him some momentum so he could swing back up.
They were like the other gladiators on the side with those jousting things, trying to joust him off.
There was like Rhino and Hunter. Just like going, get out of it, get out of it. He's like, and it was after
Wolf
that.
Wolf was
after
swinging
that.
Towards him. Yeah, anyway.
Oh, God. And it was at this moment that he kind of like believed. He was a bit like, I've been warned that I was possibly going to get hurt in Venice, and now I've had a little fall from a horrible thing. If he had some Assassin's Creed skills, he'd be right down, wouldn't he?
Yeah,
he just hung there like a,
John Old,
like a John Old, like a right old John Old.
So we can't really hold it back for much longer. So the girl in the red coat turns around, and it's some random dwarf woman. And then she gets like a cleaver out, slices his neck, and then he dies. But when he's dying and he's bleeding out, it cuts to all of the premonitions he sort of had throughout the film. So when he saw his wife earlier and the gondola hearse, that was him seeing his own death sort of thing.
His own funeral, yeah. And then there was a bit where some blood sort of fell onto what looked like an image, which from the start.
Yeah.
So it kind of like came full circle.
It's an odd ending.
Yes.
Like, is it a good ending? I think it is a good ending because it's so sort of... It just shakes you, like you just don't expect that. But I do feel like I think maybe they could have developed that whole serial killer side story a little bit more. Because weird that becomes the main. Like,
I think if they focus a lot more on the serial killer element, and they focus a lot more on his sightings of this little girl, as if she was kind of like everywhere,
and also
really hammered home that it was going to be the girl, and then it wasn't. I think then it would have been a lot more shocking.
Like if they hammered home that it was the girl she was running away from. the killer or something. But so logically, this little dwarf woman in the red coat is a serial killer. She's been killing people. What was her plan when John was chasing her then? Because like, if she's a serial killer, surely she should be. How did she know that he was going to be attracted by a red coat? Or like, you know, because she was running away from him. That's not what serial killers do. Surely she should be running towards him. Or
who knows? Who knows what her agenda was? Maybe she didn't even have a red coat on. Maybe the red coat was him. Was him sort of like imagining? He was projecting.
Yeah,
onto
good
her.
Point. Or maybe she didn't even exist. Maybe it's just like a figment of his imagination or something.
And he shanked himself, didn't he?
Shanked himself. Cut himself on a bit of glass or something, I don't know.
Bloody hell, John Old.
Yeah. Okay, so what did you think to the directing style in general?
I thought it was good. I thought it was very good. It was very good at sort of making the audience sort of feel very uneasy. Very sort of like disjointed, hard to sort of follow, hard to sort of like what's going on, but not in a frustrating way as such, more in like an inquisitive way, and it left feeling very curious.
I feel like
I thought it was good.
This style, like, it is like a very unique style. I feel like it has been imitated and parodied in various ways. That whole like non-linear cutaway thing, I feel like I'm seeing that more and more in TV, where it will be like someone will be talking. And it was like a cutaway to the next day where like the people... In fact, I'm thinking Ben Wheatley in... what was the film we did on this list?
Kill List.
Yeah, so in that one, they even do it there where they're sort of walking, playing with the kids, and it's cutting away to other parts in the timeline. And I feel like I've seen it more often. They do it in The Leftovers a little bit. I'm sure I've seen it in like various... those sort of big American TV shows. But it is so effective.
It's effective. When it's done right, it's good, and it's effective. When it's done wrong, it can be a bit confusing. It can kind of upset upset the narrative a bit.
Yeah.
But with something like this, where the narrative is quite broad and it's not like A to B, you can afford to kind of jump around a little bit to try and put the pieces together of this tragedy.
And in terms of like the whole the visual metaphors and the story metaphors, so the original short story wasn't based in Venice, had nothing to do with water. Even the daughter didn't even drown in the original story. That whole thing, so the daughter drowns, you hear the water. The in Venice, that's sort of a great sort of metaphor because they're all trapped by the water. You can't sort of maneuver around the place properly because you're sort of constricted by
I mean, water. I've kind of like always wanted to go to Venice. It's definitely on the list. Yeah, I want to go there at some point very soon. This film, even though it kind of painted Venice in a terrifying light, made me kind of want to go there even more.
Me too. I love the idea of walking around those sort of weird little back streets and alleyways and stuff. I look at that.
What would you do if you're in Venice then? You saw a tiny little girl in a red coat.
Kick her in the face.
Mr. Condor, can you explain again why you kicked the child in the face?
Have you seen Don't Look Now? I'm sure they have.
Don't Look Now. You're free to go.
Yeah. And it's happened to me many times before. Okay, jump scares or shitty pants moments. That guy shouting when he got lost and the guy goes... Like, it just seems to come out of nowhere. And he like opens his window thing.
Blet!
I think he's putting something out to dry or something. Like, he's beating a carpet or something. Just screaming his head off. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
But the main one for me was the dwarf at the end.
Yeah, that was a bit like, ooh, what the hell? Ooh, yuck. blind lady titting herself up. That was out of nowhere. So that kind of made me feel...
Yeah,
A bit uneasy. I'm not sure I felt about that. Was I aroused? Was I terrified? Halfway.
Yeah.
Between both.
Okay. Are you ready for some trivia?
Yes.
Okay, number one. It was supposed to be rated X on account of it being too sexy for screen in the US. After Roeg cut 9 frames out of the film, nipple shots and such, they managed to avoid the X rating.
I thought you were going to say he cut 9 minutes out of that sex scene.
Yeah.
Mr. Roeg, you've got a 9.5-minute sex scene here.
He cut about 9 inches out of the sex scene.
Yeah, he did. He cut about 9 inches off of Donald's hair.
So true or false?
True.
They had to, but it still got, although they avoided the X rating in the US, it's still...
X rating?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Imagine.
X for sex.
Even in 1973,
yeah.
going into like a cinema or something, going, I'm about to watch an X-rated film. I feel incredibly dirty. And then sitting down and watching Don't Look Now.
Yeah, I know. So,
well, that was a waste of...
Where does that come from? X meaning porn or like sex?
I don't know. I guess the X was probably used at some point to kind of replace what the letters were in the title of something, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
It might have said penis and it was like X's.
This is a penis rated film, guys.
Yes.
I don't want to get that penis rating. Okay. Number two, Julie Christie, the actress who played Laura, attended a seance to prepare for her role.
Ooh,
in this film.
Interesting.
True or false?
True.
That is true. I don't have any details, but it's true. Okay, number three.
All I want.
Donald Sutherland, in preparation, attended a porn shoot.
False.
That is, you are correct, it's false. It's
but
true.
He did attend a jazz concert and had sex at the jazz concert.
He did have sex.
So he knew exactly what could... Yeah.
As a bit of training, he was like, I need to have sex at least once to know.
Yes,
what to
I need
do.
To. Come yeah. on. Come on, okay. You guys. Have you had sex before, Donald? Well, yes, plenty of times.
So, number four, the film was on a double bill with The Wicker Man. Don't Look Now was the main feature, and The Wicker Man was cut down and billed as a B movie. Wicker Man, which is actually higher up on our list here. So, suck on that, Roeg. True or false?
True. It sounds believable.
Yeah, true, yeah. It's weird, because I think, I kind of feel like, is Wicker Man a B movie? It doesn't seem very B movie to me. I guess this is the more artier one, though.
This is very arty. This is incredibly arty.
But, like, wouldn't they go, like, for the commercial, is Wicker Man commercial? I don't know, but would they go for, like, the more standard commercial, Wicker Man is the main one, and then the arty farty one is the, you know what I mean? It's like, have some sugar, and here's a grape.
Not okay. Your best metaphor, Luke, no. But I mean, I totally understand it.
Yeah, okay.
I do like grapes.
The final question: the film was not received well by Venetians, particularly the councillors, who were afraid it would scare away tourists, especially from the trendy dwarven quarter. It's a hit spot now.
I was going to say true up until that part, but let's say true. Let's say true for the whole bit.
The dwarven quarter is now full of
hipsters. It's full of hipsters now. Hipster dwarfs.
Organic vegan burger joints.
Hipster dwarfs who cut things up with meat cleavers. And it's just,
It's true. Apart from the dwarven quarter thing.
Oh.
It's still there, but they're not worried about people being scared away. Okay, and last question. How do you like your roe egg?
How do I like my roe egg?
Hard boiled or sunny side up?
Hard boiled.
Okay, cool. Bit of hard boiled roe egg.
This is pretty hard boiled, to be fair, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's quite a bit of a noir edge, I suppose.
Little tight woven streaks and dark shadows and creepy stuff that goes bump.
This is my first roe egg film. We've got Suspiria is a roe egg film, right? Later. Oh no, that's a Dario Argento.
I did look. I did look at Roeg made The Witches, the Roald Dahl film.
That's terrifying me as a kid.
Oh. He also made The Man Who Fell to Earth, which he made after Don't Look Now. So he made this 3 years later. I did see Castaway. So he made Castaway, but the one with Oliver Reed.
Yeah. Did he make anything else? On this list, I mean, like any horrors and stuff.
He made a documentary about Glastonbury. he made that before Don't Look Now. I bet that was weird as well. I bet that was creepy. He made The Witches in 1990. A film called Cold Heaven in 1991. Don't recognize that. Two Deaths in 1995.
Interesting.
Which stars Michael Gambon. And his last film was a film called Puffball in 2007.
I cannot believe he made The Witches. That film used to absolutely terrify me as a kid.
Puffball in 2007 stars Donald Sutherland.
They're talking about his hair, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I want Donald. I know we haven't made a film together since 1973, but I'd like to make a film about your Well, it's not quite as majestic as it was in 1973. Well, let's do it, and I'll call it Puffball. Sold.
Okay, so we need to rate the film. By the way, yeah, so this is a great film, and I really like it. And The Witches is also great. Although it might not be, I just don't...
Oh, yeah. The Witches is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. The main guy's called Luke in that as well. I remember that. That's one of the reasons why I probably liked it so much. Okay.
Oh, it's me. That is me.
What are you going to give this film?
I would give this film... I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I thought the directing style was great. I thought it was a good story. I feel like a lot more could have been made of the sort of the whole serial killer dwarven quarter thing. I thought, you know what I mean? It was tense, but I feel like it could have been a lot more tense. Could have been a lot more. Yeah. I felt like it meandered perhaps a little bit for my liking. So I think I'll go for a C+ on this film.
Ooh, okay. Well, I kind of loved it. I loved the atmosphere, and I think that tone is pretty amazing. I feel like the whole, towards the end, I got the same sort of meandering sort of thing as well. And I feel like that could have been played up to like some like next level. Like Donald's could have been seeing more stuff. Maybe like, you know, there's a budget limitation here and it's of the time. But like, he was seeing more stuff. Like he was losing it a bit more, I guess. I would have liked to have seen a bit more of that sort of...
It would have been good to convince the audience that there was a little girl running around in a red coat. And was it a figment of his imagination? What was it? Why was it there?
Yeah.
And then suddenly, bang, it's not a little girl, it's a dwarf after all.
I would have liked to have seen it go a bit more midnight movie around that last sort of third act and then sort of culminate with that twist. I still think it would have been just as effective and then to have that sort of crazy Lynchian twist at the end.
Yeah.
But I'm going to give this a B+ because I really liked it and I will watch it again. Maybe a few more times. But like I said, that last act was a bit strange and meandering a bit. Okay, so that's it. That's it for this episode. Well, next week we are talking about... what are we talking about? I think it's The Innocents.
Possibly.
It's a 1960 film. Is it? Or is it It Follows?
I don't think It Follows us yet. What number are we on now?
33.
All right, so we're getting there. We are getting there. Sometimes it feels like we're not chipping into this list very much, but
we missed one. So the next one we're going to watch is the Let the Right One In, the original, not the Let Me In thing. I've seen the remake, not seen this one. I'm really looking forward to it, so it should be good.
Oh, you've not seen this one?
Nope. And the other one was good.
Oh, right. No, okay.
And the remake one was good as well. So
I think the remake was solid, but I mean, this Let the Right One In is amazing.
Yeah.
And then it's The Innocents, and then it's It Follows. So
cool. It Follows The Innocents. Okay.
It Follows The Innocents. Yes, it does. Lovely.
This show is brought to you by Story Studio Horgan Cleaver. Head over to horgancleaver.com and grab a free book. Become a patron over at patreon.com/hawkandcleaver. Thanks to Kovach Kalman for our theme music. Thanks to Acast for hosting the show. Thanks to the listeners. If you enjoyed the show, give it a rating, would you? And hit subscribe. Thanks to my co-host Ben for being a real horror dude. Thanks to that neti pot that I shoved up my snoz earlier. It sort of worked. Thanks, man.
Thank you very much, Luke. It's been an absolute delight.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.